All right, so I'm Jeffrey Higgins. Welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. We're recording this for the podcast. It's really nice to have everybody here. We've turned this into a hub for writers in the D.C. area. You are number 161 for the interviews we've done here. They go fast. We offer free space to authors. We like to make this a place where they can come and celebrate their work. So if you're an author or no one, please pass the word. We'd love to have them. It's really my joy in having this place. And thank you for eating. You're keeping us in business. This is all based on my wife Cynthia's family recipes. Thank you. Yeah, it's very good. We came in second for fine dining in Alexandria. The food is really good. So I'm excited about this interview today. Sean Haggerty is a retired special operations soldier with over 25 years of experience. He spent his younger years training and conducting combat operations with the 1st and the 75th Ranger Regiment. After 9 years in 2005, he was selected for and assigned to the Special Operations Unit at Fort Belvoir, Virginia. He spent 16 years there and finished his military career retiring as a sergeant major. He received several awards and decorations throughout his career, including 3 Bronze Stars. Thank you for your service. That's amazing. Sean recently left the Department of Science Board. His wife, Misty, is an executive officer at the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. Their children, Courtney, Travis, Samantha, and Delaney, all live in the Washington, D.C. area and are thriving, growing, and traveling along their own paths. That sounds very optimistic. I like that. That's really good. The grandchildren, Rowan, Jameson, and Wren, keep Sean and Misty busy. Sean Haggerty has combined over 25 years of service in the special operations community and deep-rooted research instincts from years of academic pursuits in history to tell his story. This story was written mostly in the plush seats of the daily Tackett Mill Pentagon commuter bus. That was your first book, right?
Yes, correct. It's some of the second.
Oh, fantastic. And the shaky bucket seats of the Franconia Springfield Largo Blue Metro line. We're definitely going to talk about doing writing havocs. I'm impressed by this already. However, a few chapters were written while traveling for work, taking advantage of uninterrupted thoughts on an airliner. One chapter was even written during an evening break while on a business trip aboard the USS Nimitz, a CVN-68 aircraft carrier in the Pacific Ocean. That's something I haven't done, so good. That's fantastic. Cabal, the book we're here to talk about today, came together during evening edits in his home shared with Misty in Lake Ridge, Virginia. Jones Point was the first novel in the Dane Cooper series, and Cabal is the second. So please welcome our guest today. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you very much.
So congratulations on the book. I know this is your second book, but it's such a big deal that if you know the numbers, it's amazing that any book ever gets published. You know, the numbers of the people who want to actually write a book is like pretty much everybody. It's close to 90%, and the people who actually start is something like 3%, and one of the 1% finish. So congratulations. That's a big deal.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Now, so it's good to have you here. For how long did Cabal take you to write? Was it faster than the first book?
Cabal was much faster. I think I figured out my process. Again, both books I was still working full-time. So I had to find, like you said, those writing habits of where can I steal moments. And I think that I figured it out in Jones Point. So yes, Cabal went twice as fast.
And how long was that from start to finish? Like, say, first drafting, how long did it take you to get the first draft out?
10 months.
Oh, that's really good. And working full-time, too. That's amazing. And so the first one took you almost 2 years?
It did. And I think it took me longer the first time, too, because I wasn't even really necessarily in the business of writing a book. I was actually writing as part of a program through the service where you get out and they try to basically teach us knuckle draggers how to become back into polite society. And one of them was...
How's that working for you?
I'm still dragging the knuckles. So I started doing this writing and I don't think I really realized I was going to write a book. And then I loaded up my computer one day and, you know, Word tells you 30,000 words. I'm like, how much for a novel? It was like 70 to 90 for a thriller. I'm like, I can do that.
So tell me about this program. I mean, that's really interesting. So what kind of writing, if you're not like writing fiction, is it just writing about your experience? Is it a therapeutic thing or what?
It was a combination of several things. I enjoyed it and I really appreciate it. And I think it helps a lot of soldiers. It's like, what do you want to do with the next chapter? Right? How are you going to take your skills? But a lot of too, I think sometimes is they're a little unrealistic. Because the guy kept telling me that at my coach, we'd talk and he'd be like, you got to follow your dreams. You want to be a writer? You got to be a writer. I said, I got to pay a mortgage. So you got to find a balance there, buddy. So that's why I went to work at the Pentagon and I did both.
Yeah, if anyone's telling you you can quit your day job and just start as a writer and make money, I mean, it happens, but it's like getting hit by lightning. I think the average is $12,500 a year from just writing nationwide as like the median, and that includes all the big writers, right? And a lot of people are making less than minimum wage on their books.
Yeah, I'm not going to say numbers right now because it's tax season. I don't want Misty to know.
Yeah, no, it's a really rough way to make books. So at some point, like, did you just get caught by the bug when you were writing this? So you're writing down things from your life, and you're like, wow, this can really be something like that. That's kind of interesting because you sort of backed into it, right?
I did. It was just like I said, I had just kind of done a short story. So the first book. What I've done in a couple different interviews is I've said that as a soldier overseas in combat, one of the things we fear the most is not death, is not the enemy. It's our families unprotected at home. So that was kind of where the impetus of the story came about. And as I started writing, I could imagine it, I could see it. And then I did a lot of nonfiction writing in college, so I had no problem writing, enjoying it. But I found this was so much more. I didn't have to read a story. I could make the story. So that was so much more satisfying.
The process of going from nonfiction to fiction is such a relief in so many ways, isn't it? You can actually just make stuff up.
It is, but also going from nonfiction to fiction, it taught me how to be organized. It taught me how to research. I think when you and I spoke the other day, I still keep 3x5 note cards in a little recipe box, and I can flip through my characters, or I can go, oop, chapter 12. What did I say again? Oh, yeah, don't make that. I know there's programs. I know there's anybody in the military is out there listening. I'm a butcher block kind of guy. I do not put stuff on the computer. I want to write it on paper, which how I handwrite the books.
Wow. You know what? It works. You know, so like I in a lot of ways, just going back to what's been working for, you know, hundreds of years. I mean, why not? Don't change it if it's not broken.
Exactly. I had a buddy of mine because actually I'm going to write a fourth book. Third book's almost done. Fourth book, and we're actually going to co-write it. And he is talking all these programs and how we're going to this. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not doing any of that, buddy. We're going to figure out a different style because I do not sit at a computer and over internet. You and I are typing on the document at the same time. That's not going to work. So
there. I've interviewed a lot of like co-writers, and it's an interesting process, right? Because you have at the beginning, you sort of have to figure out how you're going to do it. Are you each taking characters? Are you going back and forth? Are you do you know where you're going ahead of time? Like, you know, how are you doing? Somebody writing, somebody's editing, or what? But then the actual process of doing it, you do have to get organized with it because it's, you know, in the Google Docs that people are talking about where you can see the actual changes going in, those are a lot of co-writers will use something like that.
No, and I will use that. But, and he and I already kind of established this, is he is going to take, so a couple of my characters are going to go into this branch series. And I told him it's going to be your book with me. And the best way we can do it, because I'll be writing, finishing my book 3 and starting my own book 4, is he is going to write it and I'm going to edit it. So we'll plot the entire story together, and then that'll be our process. And he is 100% on board with that. I'm like, you give me a raw chapter, because like I told you before, I edit chapter by chapter. You give me a raw chapter, I'll help shape it, we'll discuss it, we like it, we move on. And I think that's going to work for us.
Have you done any editing on anything with him to see how feedback works between the two of you and criticism? Because that's also something that people have to kind of figure out their path.
Yeah, no, we are online dating right now. We haven't been in person about this. I've known him for a couple of years. He's actually got some work stuff right now. So we're just ideas back and forth. And then what'll probably end up happening is he lives in Chicago. I'll fly out there for like a week. 2 weeks, and we will sit down with whiteboards and we will get exactly the story we want. So he's got another published book, but he's big into mafia and crime, and he's kind of, since he's getting into kind of my genre, kind of following my format for these books.
So we'll talk about the book in just a second, but when he's doing a different genre like that, right? You have different reader expectations, you have different pacing, you have different, like that's not just like flicking a switch, right? It's very different. So like when you're bringing in someone who does a different genre, are you giving him books to read besides your own so he can understand what the reader expectations are, or is he already familiar with it?
He's already familiar with it. I mean, he's only got one published book, but he's written some others, he's dabbled in some others. We talk at least once a week, if not once every other week. We talk about, you know, different books that are out there. He's read all mine. He's a beta reader for me, so he knows how I write my style. It's not going to be easy, but the other thing too, personality wise, we get along great. Like, that's sometimes one of the most important things in any place you work or anything you do. It's personalities if I can work 8 hours a day with this person.
Well, so, like, the fact that he's been your beta reader and he's familiar with your writing is good, because you have to write with one voice, right? You can't have chapters that are different or people start sounding different. So how do you find the voice? And I know you haven't done this yet, or you're just you're in the early stages, but how do you find a voice with this other person? Like, what's the plan to make sure? Are you just sticking with his voice and then you're doing the editing, as you said? Or are you going to try to come together so it's like a melding that your two voices?
Yeah, it's going to be the latter, and I think a lot of it, too, is, and he kind of agrees, is it's going to be kind of in the current voice that these are, because it is a spin-off. It's my Thor movie to my Avengers, right? So it's going to have to keep somewhat of the same voice, but he's going to bring his own flavor to it, of course. And that's where the whole, when we spend a couple weeks together and we set everything up, and we get every, like, even now, I'm in my book three, today I edited a chapter that's leading into that book, so I've already started the voice in the third part of my final book, but it'll change a little bit, and I think that's what'll make it interesting.
Have you created like a series Bible or something, or rules for characters, things that can and cannot happen? Like, that's very common if someone like adopts somebody else's series.
Yes. So I have an entire database of my character sheets that are 10 pages each. I have all the backstories, all the, what is it, Myers-Briggs, all the back family stories, education, what handed they are, everything. So, yeah, and he's got those as well, and he's studying those.
You know, you can plug your manuscripts into a notebook LM and just ask it the question, and it'll do it for you in like 8 seconds. I should have told you this like a few months ago, right?
Where's the fun in that?
All right, so I want to go back to something you said. You talked about, you know, being deployed, and the real fear is the families back home. So the people who are deployed, they're sheepdogs, right? They want to protect the country. They want to protect people. So how do you deal with that overseas when the people you care most about are not with you and they're undefended?
Well, that's a horrible thought. I think that's a lot of the anxiety. I think that's and I think over time, again, I spend most of my time in the special operations community. Everybody knows we're spoiled brats. I had access to email. I had access to a satellite phone. I could check in more often. But you get some of these poor soldiers who are in third ID and out on a tank for 4 months at a time and don't have any connection. I think that's what they're trying to fix. I think that connection is helping. I also think that the military communities, I never personally lived on a base, but I know the camaraderie in a base, especially with spouses and children and services on the bases, are not only, they're vastly improving from what I've seen when I came in 1996. So they're creating more of those communities, and I think that's helping give soldiers a peace of mind when they're overseas.
Is there a flip side to the, like, increased communication where, because of the tensions when people are separated like that, or you might learn things that you otherwise wouldn't have known, you know, like, 50 years ago when you're deployed? Are there other things that come up that make it more difficult being that interconnected?
I'm sure additional stressors could come in. You know, raccoon got in the garbage last night. My car broke down. I'm sure. I do think, though, the family connections probably outweighs those. In my mind. But again, that's up to those individuals and their relationship.
So on this, I'm really interested in this book, and you got interested in writing. When you did this first book, like, that, it's a big lift, like learning fiction and learning all the tools. And I mean, it takes a million words to really develop craft. And you've obviously got a good work ethic here, and I think you proved that with your prior service, right? But so like, what were the steps you took to develop your craft specifically? Like, you're like, okay, I want to do this. This is good. I think I can do it. It's within reach. How do you teach yourself to be a fiction writer that's competitive in this market? Because you're competing with everybody, right? You're competing with Jack Carr. You're competing with everybody who writes in this genre.
I think because I didn't have to. I was paying my mortgage. I had a job. I was doing all these things. This was for me. And even when Jones Point first came out, I self-published. I couldn't get it. I wrote so many query letters. I went down all those rabbit holes, and I finally said, okay, I can do this. I've got the time. I've got the extra little cash I can spend. So I think there's no pressure. And I think that's what's really helped me not only stay true to this, but, it's my hobby. People are like, what's your hobby? I write books. Okay, well, like, what's your hobby? Can you whittle? No. Can you make your own bullets? No. Do you work on your car? Absolutely not. I work on my books.
Did you read books on craft? Did you listen to, like, craft podcasts? Did you work with a book coach? Did you join, like, you know, like, did you get any external, like, influence in how to do this?
Nope.
So did
now,
you read
since,
a lot?
I have since I've done the Save the Cat series. I met you at the conference. I started meeting other authors and discussing crafts. But really, oh, as a kid, I read everything known to man. You know, I've said this before. I was that kid in the grocery store. I'd look at a toy, and my mother would be like, no. I'd point to the TV guide. She'd go, okay, because it's got words. So I was given anything I wanted to read. And I think that's what really gave me the basis for helped me writing and crafting.
So what about when you read something that's bad? Does that help you to see things that you shouldn't do? Or does it actually hurt you where you need to just be kind of looking, like, up the hill at people who are, you know, more advanced in craft?
No, I think it helps because I look and I say, okay, there's a mistake. Because, again, an avid reader. I mean, and again, my father and I, my mom and I, when I got older, we didn't read the same books. You know, I didn't want Fabio on the cover. But my dad and I read, you know, the Clancys, the Deavers, all that. So I have devoured every single one of those books. And even now, I don't read as much as I used to because I'm writing. And I try not to read in my genre when I'm writing because I don't want to accidentally adopt a voice. But I find mistakes, and I find something, and I write that down. Don't do that. You know, there's another pitfall.
Do you also write down when you see, like, a cool technique or something? Or, like, do you ever go back and be like, how do you do that, and figure out what that technique was?
Yes and no. So for me, one of the things that I have to be very careful with is because, not anymore, but the clearances I had and the things that I was exposed to. So, for instance, on a lot of these, like, I read these thriller books, and they're like, yeah, the killer walked down the street, and he shot the guy in the car, and then he broke in this other car. And I was like, well, you were on that camera right there for the light. The ATM caught you. The mom and pop caught you. Your cell phone's on the front seat, so the tower's probably that panel.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I try to kind of use some of that at the unclass level. Mm-hmm. That's where I try to bring a little more realism in. And that's where I think sometimes people just fairy dust, which is neat. There's times you need to, and you can't. You do not want an entire chapter about, you know, timing sequences off which panel on a tower and how you get it. We're all going to fall asleep. But you have to give a little realism, right? The guy just walking down the street murdering in broad daylight, get away with it. You kind of go, really?
So where do you draw the line between, like, more procedural, where you're going into the actual nuts and bolts of how this operation would take place, versus, you know, keeping the pacing going and keeping the reader moving?
I do it the first time. I'll give you the nuts and bolts. And then later on, it's assumed during a mission. So, like, I had another mission in this book. In the second book, I briefly re-explained, basically, hey, the guy made sure he turned on the machine and all the cell phones got sucked to there so nobody could call out for help, right? I didn't go into the techniques of how it's done. I didn't break any classifications, even though it is at the unclass level. But I'd already talked about it in Jones Point, so you should have remembered it. But I gave you a reminder, without getting into it. Because you're an author. You know someone's going to complain about everything, right? I even said it on several interviews. There's some guys who were like, you talked about 3G phones. Yeah, because currently it's 4 and 5G phones, and if I say anything, that could be current operations. I gave you 15-year-old technology on purpose. Come on, guys, stay with me. And they're like, oh, okay.
How much is that in the back of your mind, like, when you don't reveal, like, means and methods and or stumble into anything that's classified? Because so much is an open source at this point. But how much, when you're writing, does that, like, inhibit you?
It doesn't inhibit me as much. Because, and you know, we were talking to you when we talked the other day and set this up, is my editing process is not traditional. I write a chapter, I edit the chapter. I write a chapter, I edit the chapter. I get 10 chapters, I edit those 10 chapters. I then do 5 more, and then it sends out to betas. So I'm all along the way. Then before it goes anywhere, it's got to go to DOD, because I still hold a clearance. So I still have to submit myself through DOPSR.
So how fast is that clearance process through DOD? Because I know from other agencies it's really sped up from, like, 10 years ago.
It has. It's funny you ask this. So Jones Point took about 6 months, which is the standard. When I worked for the Defense Science Board, whenever those scientists write papers, I had to go through DOPSR. So I might have known the guys. I might have sent it from my government account, which was totally legal. So they were like, oh, and they called me, Sean, you got a book in here? Yeah. All right, we'll try to get to it quickly. I'm like, okay. Thank you. And that took about 3.5 months.
So in these books, like, you're trying to evoke emotion from readers, right? That's what draws readers. It's like a magnetism, right, into the mm-hmm. book. So how much of your previous experience is about that, is about the emotion versus like the nuts and bolts you're talking about of the operation.
I don't know. It's not necessarily about experience because I haven't experienced these things in either book. I think it's the what my visceral reaction would be, right? You know, I always keep saying I'm not Dane Cooper, and my wife will pop her head around the corner. Yes, you are. So, but it's how I would react. What would happen if one of my daughters was taken? What would happen if I was confronted with somebody? Would I take that life? Would I save that person? Would I do that? You know, some of the language, some of the is typical of myself and other people I know. I've got characters throughout the books, and every one of them is based on somebody I know. Maybe they weren't in that situation, but I put them in there.
Yeah, I love that. So let's start with Jones Point a little bit. Like, can you just tell us basically what's that book about? This is your debut book.
So it's about a father when his daughter's kidnapped. He descends into the brutal underworld, joining a clandestine cabal of grieving parents who decide to find their own justice. And along the way, they discover that there's a group of abductors out there in some sort of conspiracy that believe they are saviors and are actually doing good, not bad, by taking away these children.
Yeah, I love that. There's so much good stuff in that, right? You've got your pitch down, too, by the way. I like that. So, and Cabal, what's this is the sequel.
So it's the sequel, and again, I can't say too much because I'll ruin Joan's point. All I can simply say is the Cabal is the group, and they've been somewhat successful, and now they find themselves being picked off one by one. So somewhere there's a leak, somehow they've been compromised, and they're racing to still save children and or protect themselves and some of the weaker members of the club.
So how hard is it to write a series versus standalone, right? Because you've got a world that's already created, but then you have a lot of things that you have to remember and a lot of things that you have to follow, and it affects your arcs. So how is it difficult?
I probably use some of those programs you mentioned. there is note cards all over my den. There is everything. And again, to some, you might say, well, you can really quickly hit this button and it'll take you to this page and show you that character. You're right. Or I can search in Word, and I'm actually reviewing a lot of other things. So I'm seeing other things. I'm like, oh, yeah, but in that scene, he acted this way. So it's almost like I'm by doing it manually, I'm reviewing my work even more.
How much when you're writing book two do you have to go back to book one as you're writing?
Book one is in the bag with me. I have a digital copy with me. But again, too, I think we had talked about this before, I'm that combination of a plotter and a panzer. I have it all arced out, but I don't know if it's going to go that way. So I do use it a lot. I use it a lot more in my editing. I'll just throw the stuff down, and then I'll go back, and I'll say, okay, hang on a minute. Let me go back to this character. Would he really have said that? No, he wouldn't have. He would have said this. So I do still. And if with the third book, I'm going through both of them.
So, I mean, do you like being in that same universe? Like, I know some authors who, I mean, there's some people who get stuck in the universe for 50, 60 books, right?
Yeah.
And they're like, I got to get out of this. Or, you know, Arthur Conan Doyle, like kills Sherlock Holmes, right, as a way to try to end it. Or do you like it? Like, have you become so close to the characters that you want to stay there?
I would say I like it for now, but I also don't want to get to the point where Dane Cooper is fighting Godzilla on the moon, right? When it's done, it's done. So, you know, I don't want to be one of those writers that just takes that character to the end of the earth and you're as a reader going, can you try something new, right? And I have no problem trying something new. But again, I'm still just getting into this world, so I'm not sick of them yet.
I think they're more market factors, you know, and when people want the book and they're asking for the book, I think that's what keeps people going. It's hard to say no to that.
Yeah.
So when you're developing, you talk about the character. When you said you mentioned you base that on somewhat on people that you know.
Yes.
So like walk us through the process a little bit. Like did the idea come first or the character? Like the plot idea, high concept idea.
Oh, a plot idea. The whole plot idea came first.
Do you remember what started that? What triggered that? I'm always curious about that because sometimes it's hard to remember exactly how it developed.
So the first thing I ever wrote. And I forget which chapter it is in Jones Point. It's when you're introduced to Carl Blanchard. And he was on the bus. Because I commuted in, like a lot of people. You commute in on the big commuters. And then you have to jump a city bus sometimes to get to your other spot. And I'm not dogging the city buses. But sometimes those can be a little bit different than the commuter. I've seen people nod. So in that. And it was during a very volatile time with BLM and the police, and then I didn't get political, but I got that people were angry at the police and someone berating him, and he's like, I'm just trying to go to work and do my job, right? So that was the first scene I ever wrote. And then I kind of tucked it aside. And then I was doing something with writing fiction for overseas, and that's where I started the Dane Cooper kind of side, and that's the opening scenes in Bamako, Mali.
So you had this scene, and you thought at some point you'd use it.
Correct.
But like, how did this whole concept for the series, like, do you remember, like, how did something in real life spark that, or was it something you heard, or were you doing the what ifs? Like, do you remember how that actually came to you?
No, I think it was just like I said when I was getting out, and I was just dabbling with some writing, and I was goofing around on, you know, different little stories. Because when I was deployed, I used to write for my girls. I used to write these silly little princess stories and stuff. So I had no problem, you know, spinning tales. But I was like, I need to up it a little bit. And it was a hobby. It was something to do to occupy my mind.
Were any of those princesses getting abducted?
Not in those stories.
How graphic did we get with the princess stories? I think.
No, they were very tame. They were very tame. They were conquering dragons in far off worlds.
So I mean, so you know, if you're doing that for your kids and you have this bug, like you said, you read a lot when you were younger. At what point did you have that moment when you're like, I can do this? When you were a kid, like, at what point did you ever want to be a writer?
I didn't. I mean, I literally fell into this. I literally started writing, and then again, my wife would be like, "What are you doing?" And I'm like, "I'm working on a novel." She's like, "Are you sure?" I said, "I think I am." And she's like, "Well, get to it.
You should know. If anyone knows, it should be you." So the idea of story captivated you very early, right? You were reading. You said you'd read anything. You'd read the,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So what is it about that so interested you and that stuck with you so that, you know, as a hobby, you're writing? I mean, I feel like the germ of this was there from a very early on. You know, even though maybe you didn't recognize it, I feel like your
Probably.
Love of story was there early.
Yes. Yeah, it definitely was. But I guess I never imagined myself as the creator of the story. I was always the consumer. Mm-hmm. And I also, one thing I really like about, you know, a really good story captures me is when it immediately goes in my head and I'm immediately playing it, you know, the pictures in my mind. And not just snapshots, that it's flowing. And as I was writing this, I'm seeing that as well when I do that. So when I'm writing, I'm watching this like flow like on a movie. And that's how I'm writing what I'm seeing.
And so one question I tend to ask the people I interview is, where does story come from? And I'm curious about that because you're basically watching the movie, and a lot of writers will talk about it. It's almost passive, like the story's coming through you, you're channeling it, you know, you're trying to write this down. Where is that movie coming from?
I have no idea. I was writing my chapter 20 in my coming up book, Phoenix, and I went a completely different direction. I have no idea how that happened. I have no idea how I ended up there, and I went, wow, that is really cool. Let me go change two things from 16 and 14, and then we remap the board for the remaining chapters because we're going this direction now.
I love that you went with it because a lot of writers won't. You know, they'll say, oh, I planned this and this is what I'm doing, but the story clearly wanted to do that. But that's a weird moment, and I think people who aren't writers, even people who are avid readers, will be like, what? What happened? You know, like, because it's surprising you. How are your characters surprising you?
I don't know. I hear what you say. Yeah, I think they surprised me more as I've gone along. They didn't surprise me much in Jones Point, right? Debut, first novel, not as experienced. Cabal, I started giving them that little bit of freedom, you know? What would he do? Where is he going to take me? And now this last book, like I said, the arc that I did today, I knew had to be worked out. I have a joke with my neighbor. My neighbor's like, you check your... We live down our driveway and then like one of those like pipe stems. So my mailbox is all the way down there. He's like, you check your mail like 10 times a day. He's like, what's wrong with you? I said, that's when I get up, when I'm stuck I'm like, how did he do that? How did that get to there? And my feet just start walking. And I just walk down and I'm like, well, I might as well check the mail. I'm down here. And that's kind of like my process to nudge something loose real quick.
Yeah, I would say almost every writer I've talked to has the same thing. So there's actually neuroscience behind that when your body's in motion and to break something free and also to let your mind wander and have ideas come to you. Mm-hmm. Have you ever done that, like, intentionally, too? Like, I just interviewed a writer who writes on a treadmill for that reason. You know, I dictate a lot so I can walk when I'm writing. Do you ever say, I'm just going to get in motion so I can figure this out?
No, I haven't. Just the mailbox thing, really. Just the mailbox thing. Yeah, no, I mean, but it is that. I mean, it's a mailbox up and down the street, or this Amazon package got delivered wrong to our house for once. We get quite a few. And it was like four houses down. I was like, perfect, take a break. I'm thinking, I'm walked down. By the time I walked back, I was like, I know how to fix this.
You know, if I was your neighbor, I'd stick story ideas in your mailbox and really freak you out.
That would be hilarious.
All right, so I'm curious, like, because you were new to this, you were surprised, you really fell into this. What was the most surprising or hardest thing about, even your first book or your second book, the hardest thing about writing a fictional book? I mean, it's really a difficult process. What surprised you?
Wow, you got me on that one, because it didn't really, nothing really, it's the after, it's everything after that surprised me. Everything after that, you know, all the editing, all the stuff, you know, when I finally got a publisher was great, but then it's like, okay, it's going to be about 6 months. I'm like, for what? What? Right? The concept was in my mind, it's going to take them 6 months. You just got to grade my paper. Come on, let's go. You know, the advertising, the marketing, the, you know, going to, you know, book functions, going to this and that. I mean, so again, I'm working full time, not trying to make things an excuse, but I didn't have the luxury of, you know, I finally got to go to BoucherCon. I finally got to go to Killer Nashville because I may have taken that government buyout and left my job and was a non-starving artist for 5 months. So that's what surprised me.
Yeah, I mean, I think it surprises a lot of people. But I'm really curious. You obviously formed a writing habit quickly. Did your previous, like the discipline in your previous career, do you think that's what helped you do this?
Yeah, I believe it's that. And like I said, it was also the writing in college when I had deadlines and I had papers and you know, you're doing a million things and you have to, I'm big into don't waste time, right? This is here, this is here, this is here, and I'm done by here, period, right? I set goals too, or I'll be sitting up to 3 a.m. Now, don't get me wrong, I catch a great idea. Yep, honey, let the dog out. Good night. I'm going to keep writing, but I try not to do that.
But that's unusual in the fact that those were external, pressures that you had before in school, and now you're doing it to yourself, right? Like, that's a lot of writers, especially when they're writing on spec, they don't have a contract, they sort of lose that impetus or they lose that pressure to get up, and because it's hard. It's hard work, and it's something you're doing in your spare time. What kept you going with that?
Well, I feel so bad because I don't have a job anymore, and I watch my wife get up at 5:30 in the morning, so I get up too. And I shower, and she goes to work, and I go in the den, and I start working. Now, I may not start writing. I may balance my spreadsheets. I may check the news. I may check sales. I may do something like that. But, yeah, then the next hour, I'm like, well, she's working. I got to work. I can't just sit around.
What do you do to get yourself in that creative space? Because if you're checking spreadsheets, that's not necessarily a creative. Well, it shouldn't be a creative space. Maybe
no,
it is. I'm
no,
not sure
no.
what you're doing with your taxes.
No. I think what it is I let my mind... Excuse me, I let my mind wander in the morning. I read some news. I look at a couple funny memes. I listen to the TV. I maybe play a little quick game on my phone. I just kind of let everything relax. I wake up. I drink a couple cups of coffee. You know, mess around with the dogs a little bit. And then I grab my stuff. And now that I'm not riding the bus anymore, I have a writing spot on my couch. I sit down. I grab my Remarkable. I've got my notes all around. I got the TV remote real close. I got my phone. I got like 3 pair of glasses because I keep dropping them. Boom, dog's next to me, I start writing.
Is a dog a necessary component there?
You know what? Sometimes, yes. It's nice to have him nearby. There's times when I wish he'd go to the really expensive pillow I bought him.
As long as he's not telling you things are right, I think we're safe.
Yeah. That's at night, not in the mornings.
So... Do you write, like you said, you have like deadlines and things? Do you write to a specific word count or a page count or to a specific number of hours in a day?
So, yes and no. So the hours in the day is if I have, like I said, we were right up until I left to come grab some family from the airport. That I was literally just ended editing a chapter. Word count. So my word count for Jones Point was around 3,500 a chapter. For Cabal, I brought it down to about 3,000. For Phoenix, I'm moving it a little faster. It's down around 28. It's not hard and fast, but I've got, with the way the storylines are set, I don't have any professional training. It's as me as a reader that I want to, you can only give me so much and get back to the other storyline, and I don't ever want a reader to have to go back to one of my other chapters to see what's going on. So that's why, as it gets a little more complicated closing out the series, I say closing out, there'll be more. But I want to keep the reader engaged and make sure that I haven't, that they're getting, all the loops are getting closed that need to be closed.
So how do you do that when you're bouncing back between two different parts of the story or two point of view characters? Like, how do you say it's a distance or time that you're going through. You don't want to go too far or too long.
Correct.
But then how are you keeping them engaged to want to get back to that? How are you ending those scenes or those chapters?
I've got to have a little hook at the end of every chapter that you want to know more about storyline B or storyline A or the main storyline. So, and I write from four characters' point of view. So it's not Omni, it's not everything. So it's the main character and then the main person in each storyline.
And when you're building those characters, are you thinking about how they're going to interact together? I mean, you said basing them on people you know, but like how do you actually flesh out these characters? Like with weight, because they have to change, right? So you have to have arcs. They have to start in one place. They have to have some kind of frailty or problem or something to overcome. Walk us through that. How does this work with four POV characters?
Yeah, I sometimes bit off more than I can chew. Some of the arcs are not as complete as others in each sequence of the book. So in the first sequence, obviously the main character, Dane, and with the protagonist, the abductors, is very, very detailed and very, very complete. The second one with the FBI is actually, it grows throughout the books because he actually takes off of book one, kind of he hits his arc in three and then really screws things up, and two, it screws things up in three. And then the police are the same way. And then they've got the abductors. That's my fourth point of view, if you would. Fourth characters telling the story. And, they're like just bad heart monitor just all over the place. But I think that keeps, it's like everything else. There's rules until there isn't rules. So sometimes, you got to break them. Sometimes you might find something different that'll catch people. So not everybody has a complete arc. Not everybody has a complete. They'll have closure. I'm not going to do that to people. But some people might not find what they're looking for.
Well, that's a form of an arc too, right? You can find it or not find it or change. But how do you do that over a course of three, four books? Like, because within a book or in a standalone, you have these really steep arcs, so mm-hmm. People feel the change. But when you're doing a series, you still have to grab people with each book. So each book has to stand alone, and you have a longer one, so you have shallower arcs. So how do you do that? Yeah. I'm asking for a friend.
Yeah, so it basically was, if you think about my three books in a row here, it's Act 1, Act 2, Act 3. Mm-hmm. And inside each one, I've got to have those beats, right? But I've got to have tragedy near the end, all is lost, and then, something, but then what I do then is I have an all is lost at the end. And then that'll bring you to the next book. So that's kind of how I've done the arc. And then again, since it's an investigative thriller series, I get to cheat a little bit, and I get to get, hey, catch me up on where are we at with that suspect, and I can give you more data from the first book so I can tie them together easier. But that's one little cheat you get when you're doing that. But that's really how my books are set up.
So do you follow like the hero's journey? You're talking about like the Darkest Night, some of these classic beats within that?
Yep. What is it? Yeah, it's the heroes. I got it written down somewhere. I haven't looked at it in so long. But yeah, I wrote all that up. But that was after the second book. I just discovered those from a friend and started using it for the third book. I never used anything for book one and two.
But you read a lot. So, I mean, in some ways, you probably internalize a lot of these because story has only so many structures,
Oh, yeah.
People can break it down in different ways and market it in different ways, but it really, story is, you're presented with something, you fight against it, it has a resolution.
Yeah. No, like when the first time I read Save the Cat, great book, but I finished the book and went, yeah, right? But like you said, it's ingrained already in our head. It's ingrained in how we consume entertainment or we watch TV or we watch plays, we watch this and that, the classic good versus evil and the classic storyline. It's like a Hallmark movie. I know the rich, powerful businesswoman is going to fall for the hunky old ex-boyfriend who runs the local cute, quaint motel, right? But it's going out of business, right? It's the same.
He's a guy with the Labrador Retriever, right?
Exactly. Out back chopping wood in the middle of the winter with no shirt on.
So I'm curious a little bit about you've traveled a lot. You've been in these very strange places. How much does that show up in your books? And how important is setting?
So, it is important because it still is a military character, even though it's not a military book. And we do deal with a lot of he does have obviously some layers of PTSD, and that's exacerbated by the loss of a child. So you see a lot of flashbacks. You see a lot of tension in his life. You see a lot of dream sequences. So those settings and locations, like I said in this book, are all true settings, all true locations. Most of them are all true events. Like the names changed to protect the innocent. So, and some of the locations, obviously, I had to falsify due to classification. But those, very, very, I thought very important to be that authentic. I mean, you really want to, you know, if you want to talk Bamako Mall and you've been there, I better describe it. I've been there. I better describe it. Just how it is, or I'm not being faithful to the readers.
So there's a real art to describing setting. How much do you put in? And, like, what is it you're looking for to give the reader the feel of place without turning it into, like, a travel log?
Got it. So I will say, first off, is in these books, I have traveled. I have been to every single location and every single spot and every single park and every single city. I've been there. Number two, I write it like I like to read it. I want you to, as an author, to give me enough information that I know what you're talking about, but enough latitude that I can create my own story. I want people to read these books, and you might have read it slightly different than someone else, slightly different. It meant something different to you. You imagined something different in your head. Perfect. That's fine with me, as long as the core of the story is there.
Is there anything else in life where that happens, where people have these just completely unique experiences looking at something that's very concrete? It's in black and white in a book, right? And you had the picture in your head, but like you say, the two of us might read it and have completely different stories.
Oh, I think that's in everyday life, everything that goes on in this world. I mean, everybody's got a different perspective. We've all got unique. I mean, sometimes, unfortunately, our detriment. I mean, look at how people are today at each other's throats over issues, and you might say, well, I think my way is completely right. It's logical. And you might say, well, I think my way, right? We all see things differently. We have different experiences. We're different humans. We've been raised differently. We've lived in different areas. We've tasted different foods.
Speaking of which, your menus are in front of you. Feel free to continue. So you've been in these places when you're now, but some, I would assume some of them it's been quite some time. What do you do to refresh yourself when you're writing in a scene? Do you go back, or is it just all from memory?
It's mostly all from memory. I may go back and like look at some pictures, either that I have very few, but or some stuff that's in the news, or some stuff like if I was writing and it was 2012, I might look at some footage from Afghanistan 2012 to remind myself. But those places they're burned in there. I don't think they're going anywhere. So I didn't really, like, I write about an attack in a compound, and I can draw that right today, the entire thing, down to the detail of where the spigots were. I mean, I live there.
So you mentioned that, like, you see this running as a movie in your head. Do you find that there's one sense in particular that when you're thinking of a place, do you use all the senses for your characters, or is there one thing, does smell come back to you?
Smell, it's funny you mention that, because in book three I was realizing that in the senses that I discuss in one and two, I do not use smell as much, and I started bringing it in. I actually have a character going through in Chicago, the old yards, the old South, and even though it's, I think they went up out of business in the 70s, no more slaughter yards. I'd have them describing what it must have been like back then, or what Upton Sinclair had said in the jungle, the smells. They said, you know, and the taste in the air was like sucking on a copper penny,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to bring that out more. I'm usually more sounds in sight and trying to bring back some more of the other senses.
Do you find you have new challenges with each book? You're in book three now, or almost done with book three. Are there new things that come up as you're writing more?
I keep finding myself creating like new problems, and I'm like, stop, you got to solve all the problems from one and two, stop creating. That's what today's spin was. I created a whole new problem. I was like, you've only got about 20,000 words to tidy this up. You better figure this out.
What is the word count you shoot for?
I shoot for around 90 to 100.
Yeah, that's a sweet spot for it. So you tell us a little bit more about your process, because this is so different for every writer. You're writing by hand.
Writing by hand.
Pencil, pen.
Okay, originally, Jones Point was written all on legal yellow notebook paper, and I have it stacked about that high in my office. The problem was that I come home each evening, I'd put on one of those stands, and then I would type it into the computer. My wife laughed at me hysterically and went and bought me a Remarkable. So now I handwrite at the Remarkable, hit it, the convert to text, and then I use the digital age and I zap it to my computer. Now, it's not perfect, but it does come up that it's editable. And then I edit there. So I write a chapter, edit a chapter, write a chapter, edit a chapter.
So your handwriting's good enough that it can recognize the words?
Sometimes it takes me longer to edit that chapter. So, yeah, I print. I'm not trying to write in cursive, so it's fairly decent.
And why is that? Is that something you did in the field, or like what is the connection? Is it the tactile sensation when you're writing? What is it?
It's something that my brain is connected to, my hand is connected to a writing instrument, probably because of how I grew up writing and doing stuff. Even in college, we didn't have computers yet. We were still handwriting. So I think that's probably why. Now, I can edit on the computer, but I cannot sit and write on the computer. It drives me crazy.
Have you ever tried to dictate?
You and I talked about that the other day. I've tried, and I know it's a whole different mental process that you've got to really switch over and do. I guess it's one of those things, if it's working for me, I always look at and go, should I really switch? Maybe I'll try it for book four.
So do you read your stuff out loud? Like you mentioned, the editing process. How many times, once you have a first draft, and you're going back as you go, but when you finish, I assume you have some more editing to do, right, when you get to the end, or are you done?
So let me see. So, yeah, so, you know, editing every really chapter, I don't think that counts. So I edit, you know, 10 chapters, edit. 15 chapters, edit betas. 20 chapters, edit. 30 chapters, betas. Publisher. I don't read it again.
When you send something out to beta readers, and do you ever get like some structural or big change or big criticism, and how does that affect your creative process moving forward?
So what I usually get is a mix. I've got some that I want, you know, that I like, they're going to give me content. They're going to be like, I didn't see that character saying that, or you forgot that he doesn't like cursive, you know, things like that, which is good. Then I have a buddy who's a retired creative writing professor. And he will talk structure and flow, and he would be like, hey, neat, that needs to be seen, get rid of that dialogue, that needs to be dialogue, this, you're losing here, pick up the beat here, I need something. So he gives a real deep structure of the book.
I mean, that's a real gift to have somebody like that you can use. So I want. So you mentioned trying to get an agent. Do you remember how many agents on book one did you look for? Like, how many queries did you send out?
I think 50. Think about 50, and then I just... The other problem, too, is The Sound of Freedom was coming out. And this was written before it, but I didn't know anything about it. I'm hearing the buzz, and I'm scared that, right, my, you know, similar to my idea, I'm like, whoa. I immediately got that thing out self-published.
I mean, you know, they say there are only, like, 27 stories in human history or something, and it's all the telling and the, you know, the execution that makes it all different.
No, of course. I was also impatient.
So after you self-published, did you then, for book two, did you look for an agent?
So, no. So I put out to some friends on LinkedIn that I was looking for a publisher and got hit up in about 2 hours. And then about 2 hours later, I was linked up with an author at my publisher. And probably 2 days later, she had my book and a copy and was giving it to the publisher. And then probably three, four months, we pulled the first edition of Jones Point, and they picked me up and republished it like 4 months after that.
Who is your publisher?
Blue Handle Publishing.
And tell us a little bit about your experience with that, because I know a lot of writers listen to this, and it's different for everybody.
It is. It really is. So the self-publishing was cool because I controlled everything. I could see all the accounts, this and that. What I've heard from like the big ones is it's great, but they can change your story. You don't have the personal connection. The small, which it's still in a traditional, but at the time I think people were calling them boutiques. I talked to my head of publishing today. I chatted with the president a couple days ago. I can ask questions. I can ask, you know, I did an event. Can you guys check my logs to see if I got a bump in sales, if it's worth doing those events? You know, I back and forth my friend that author. Or that professor, his book's with them right now, and they're looking to acquire it. So there's that personal connection I get with them that I really appreciate. It's not the greatest on the advertising and marketing side like a big publishing house is going to do, but...
I know a lot of people with Big Five who aren't getting a lot of support in the marketing area either.
I've heard that. That's why I'm in a great little niche. You know, they do all the editing. They get everything done. First book's even already on Audible. This one's coming on Audible in the next month. So, I mean, they're moving. Just sometimes a little slower. You've got to be a little more patient, but...
Was it weird to hear your book on audio?
I didn't listen to it.
Did you listen to any of it? Did you just listen to hear
them? Yeah. I listened. Snaps came in. The narrator would ask a pronunciation of words. We get sheets. So I was back and forth on that. So I listened. I have not since downloaded the entire thing and, like, listened to it.
how much as an author are you just sick of your work by the time you go through all the editing and the writing? And it's so much work. Like, you know, a lot of people say, why aren't you going to listen to your thing? But you've probably been through this so many times at this point. Do you stop editing? Like, do you just stop when you're just done? Like, you can't look at it anymore?
Yes. Yes and no. I mean, when I feel like it's done, it's done. It's just kind of like, okay, editor, you know, this is where you pick up and you tell me, you know, content editor, line editing, steps you want to go through, you tell me what I'm on to the next project. It doesn't mean like I just throw the books away, but it's like I got to keep moving.
And how many iterations do you go through with your editors at the publisher?
Not a lot. A lot of times it's they'll hit me up as they're going through it, kind of some of the same stuff. Hey, this scene here works. I need a little more detail and I need a little dialogue here. Take that dialogue, change it to this here. And do we have the right sequence here? But other than that, and grammatical, because I can't spell, and I am just not a fan of the comma. I've been told many times. I need to become closer with the comma, because I don't like to use them. And contractions, I don't write them very well.
So when the book comes out, how does that feel? Like, you have the book here. It's a physical thing, right? It's got the stories that were in your head are now there, and you say it's awesome, but is there a part of you, too, that, especially when the first one came out, that is so weird because you live your life kind of in the shadows, right? Mm-hmm. And now, all of a sudden, you're putting stuff out there for everybody to see?
Yeah, no, it didn't bother me in the least. It really didn't. No. Because I know even, too, I think the wife would say, she's like, what if someone doesn't like it? I don't care. That's fine. Don't like it. You don't have to.
Do you read your reviews?
Yes. I don't have a ton, but I read them. Mm-hmm.
What do you do if you don't have a ton? It's so hard, right? Like, there's 3 billion books a year that are coming out. Have you found anything that actually works? And I ask this of everybody, basically, because I'm curious. Is there anything that's driving book sales? Like, so you mentioned going to an event, and maybe that didn't drive sales, but if it works with your brand or gets your name out there, you know, sometimes people have to hear your name a few times before they take action.
Is it five times, right? Isn't it five
it's
times?
Seven.
Is it seven?
Yeah.
I thought it was five. Okay. I stand corrected. I think it's the little engine that you just gotta keep pushing. It's the little engine that could, you just a little bit everywhere. You know, I went to an event and maybe only sold 5 books. Okay, that's 5 more books that someone's talking. You know, I went to the Occoquan Fair. It was awesome. I had someone call my 2 different people, 2 different days. I bought your book last year. Is this the sequel? Cool.
Oh,
I bought
that great?
It. Right. So that's really cool. Did I make money? No. Did I lose money? Yes. Did I freeze? Also yes. But I got 24 books out there.
Oh, that's great. Isn't it interesting, though, like when people think, oh, you have a book out, everyone thinks you've made $1 million.
Oh, yeah, I know, right?
Most writers are actually losing money on their titles, not to mention the 8 months that it took you to write it.
Oh, yeah. People are just like, you know, how's the book sales? Oh, I made $8.
All right, I'm gonna come around for questions. And you've got them on the spot here, so this is a really good time. I'm gonna bring both microphones so it comes out on the podcast. Before I do that, do you listen to music when you're writing?
Yes. Country music.
So with words, you're listening
with
to
words. Yep.
Is it different for the different books, or do you listen to different music for different types of scenes, or does it not matter?
Same thing. I have to have chaos. I have to be juggling many balls at a time. I can even sit, and there can be a Hallmark movie on. I think there was the other day, and I was writing.
Hallmark's taking a beating in this interview.
I know, right? No, they're great. No, I have to have chaos, noise, things. I cannot be in a total silent room.
Yeah, I'm actually the same way. There is something, though, with background noise, how that spurs creativity, and there's neuroscience behind that. But if you can actually make out the words and follow along, it starts to interfere. But you don't find that.
No. I drown it out. I'm just listening to the melody.
Interesting. All right, I'm coming around.
So you want both?
No, just sit there with your microphone, and I will come around, and I will see if anybody has a question. Here we go. We got one in the back.
So I don't know a lot about some of the technology you talked about, but what about the use of AI? Have you used any of that in your writing or thought about using any of it?
So I have not delved into that yet. I was actually writing some concepts about that last week for the next set of series, but I did not flesh it out too much because honestly, I'm not super knowledgeable in the field.
So you haven't used AI for anything in the book? I mean, it's in every
Do you use it? Have you used it yourself as a tool?
Oh yeah. I'll use AI as a tool. Like I've got ChatGPT. I think I got 5.1 or 5.2. I'll use that on a tool to like ask it some questions. Or like I said, I was doing research on the old slaughter yards in Chicago. So I was doing that to get some. You can go to Google and Wikipedia. I'm not going to go through Wikipedia. And I can ask it, but then I can ask it specific questions. Hey, what was the major intersections of this? Where was the major this? Where was the center of town? Which direction did the animals come in from? Which the port? And they went. Then I can pull that up on a map, and then I can write a story about that. So I'm just very careful. Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought you meant in the book. I'm very careful with AI as an author because, one, I mean, it's obviously the ultimate form of plagiarism. But right, it's what it's built on. That's fine. But I use it. I do use it to do research. Yes, that is accurate.
Yes.
Okay. As an author, where do you see yourself 5 years from now?
Oh, well, if everything goes according to my well-laid plans, sitting on my dock, looking out over the lake, and working on the next series of books.
Love it. Question.
So I know you mentioned that you have dabbled in other types of writing. You've done short stories. Do you see this genre as your niche, as your thing, or do you see yourself expanding outside of this particular genre?
So I do have, I've been speaking with a friend of mine, and I am possibly looking into doing his autobiography, military autobiography. He's not aboard yet. He's kind of a private man, but his wife and kids... He's had some trauma. He's had some bad injuries, but an incredible life story. So I've been talking with him slowly about how about I ghostwrite it for you.
You know, so many people in that field, right, don't want to share what they've done, or they're humble and whatever. But if the stories aren't told, they die with the person. You know,
exactly.
How do you actually encourage other people, other military people, to write down some of the things they've done or to work with a writer?
I have not personally gotten involved in that side. It's just this happens to be a friend of mine. We talk about, he doesn't a lot live in this area. We talk about once every 3-4 months, and the last two times we've talked about it, he's like, yeah, the wife's really bugging me. I'm like, oh, if nothing else, I go, we can write it. We can get it printed. You can throw it in your safe. It can be for your kids. I go, how about you don't have to share it with the public if you don't want to. I go, but we've got to capture your story.
I love it. Question.
You have had an extraordinary life. What about a biography of you?
So, that is another project that I have considered. But that one will be written and that will be thrown in my safe. And nobody can come get me for revealing secrets after I'm dead.
Okay, so... Where should readers go to find your book?
Well, the best place to initially start is my website, authorshawnhaggerty.com. There's all links to Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Bookshop, I believe. Secondly, would be go to Blue Handle Publishing website, and then their author section, I'm there. And then again, you can find me on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Everything comes up there. Like I said, both books are in print, both books are in Kindle. Jones Point is Audible, and Cabal's coming Audible soon.
Oh, that's fun. Well, congratulations. I always tell people to, if you haven't yet, go on to Amazon and leave a review. It makes a really big difference when people see a lot of ratings there. So if you're watching this or listening to this, please go out and do that. And by the way, if you like what we're doing at Elaine's Literary Salon, our podcasts are number 4 on Apple, number 3 on Spotify for Literary Salon. So please go on there and like us, join our newsletter at elainesliterarysalon.com. And we would love it if you'd leave us a review for Elaine's restaurant, too. We're just asking all the things now. That's great. Well, Sean, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it.